Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa, bringing you the News Gazette on this Wednesday, April the 8th, 2026. Let's get started on the front page. Of course, today we have a big picture of the demolition of a dilapidated building at the future site of Savoy's Downtown Plaza, an area bounded by Wesley Avenue, Main Street, U.S. 45 and Dunlap Avenue, and Church Street, and that is expected to be complete by mid-May. Picture with a lot of dirt and trucks hauling the dirt away, and the title is Groundbreaking Set for Spring of 27 by Jana Wiersema. Construction on Savoy's new downtown square is expected to begin in about a year. Downtown Development Group, the village's partner on this project, is hoping to break ground in the spring of 2027, said President and CEO Marissa Sierra. Demolition of dilapidated buildings at the site began in March and is expected to be complete by May 15th, said Village Administrator Andy Korstrom. A Phase 1 environmental study is projected to be finished by midsummer at the latest. The village is responsible for making the project site, which is bounded by Wesley Avenue, Main Street, U.S. 45, also called Dunlap Avenue, and Church Street, shovel-ready. The proposed concept consists of multiple buildings arranged in a traditional Main Street configuration around a public gathering space, Kornstrom wrote in a report to the Village Board of Trustees. The buildings are envisioned as being no more than four stories tall and will feature both commercial and residential spaces. The village has agreed to sell the subject property to the developer for a nominal fee, once certain obligations are met in regards to project planning and documentation. The village is giving the developer the land for $1, Kornstrom said, so that's a pretty significant incentive. We're confident the property is valued at least at a few million dollars. Further incentives, such as tax increment funding, have not been negotiated at this point, Sierra said. The Village Board will vote tonight on whether to amend its redevelopment agreement with downtown developers, with the group on the project, with the main change involving the public gathering space at the heart of the site. Under the original agreement, the developer is required to transfer ownership of this space back to the village at the project's end, and the village is responsible for its upkeep. Under the new agreement, the developer would retain ownership of the entire 2.82-acre project site, including the public gathering space, Sierra said. Even lining utilities and kind of the foundational pieces for the downtown and the structures were really running into some obstacles with how we would lay that out with having both public and private parcels mixed together, she explained. So we were able to work with the village, identifying how we could accomplish the shared consistent goal while reducing some of the complexities. I think the key about any project is good communication, Kornstrom told the News Gazette. We just continue to have great communication with the Downtown Development Group and village staff. And this amended redevelopment agreement, I think, speaks to that. We've both come to the table wanting to address maybe some of the improvements that we can make. The amended agreement was discussed last week's study session and has been placed on the meeting schedule as a standalone item rather than as part of the consent agenda, he said. While the proposal includes other changes, Kornstrom said, that most of the trustees' discussion and concerns were focused on the public gathering space. I think the board really believes in the power of having this green space to offer bands or to offer farmers markets or to offer community-type activities, he said. That's a very important part of this project to the board, and they want to ensure that this continues on, regardless of whether the property is owned by the village or by the developer. He added that the developer also has a very vested interest in activating the space so that people are drawn to the site and visit the future businesses surrounding the square. Per Kornstrom's report to the board, other proposed changes include an updated project description, making July 2nd, 2026, the deadline for the developer to submit a planned unit development application to the village, extending the deadline to provide proof of financing to March 30th of 2027, and donating a pole barn at the site to the developer for use during the project. The developer will be responsible for tearing down the structure once there is no further need for it, updating the number of required parking spaces to no less than 156 based on the village's unified development ordinance, creating special service area so that if the developer fails to maintain the common areas of the project, the village can levy SSA taxes on the property to ensure upkeep. Additionally, while the original concept was projected to cost the developer about $31 million, the new concept is estimated to cost approximately $18 million. The developer is expected to finish the project within 3 years of taking ownership of the property. Sierra noted that Jeremy Duzan, president of Duzan Architecture and Design, as well as Synergy Industries, has joined Downtown Development Group, while Kyle Kirchhofer has stepped away from the project. She described Duzan as an amazing architect with over 30 years of experience in both construction and architectural design, who has helped take this project to the next level. I think his experience in working with such a variety of projects and being some very, very complicated provides even more strength and support for the project, Sierra said. She added that Downtown Development Group welcomes feedback from community members as well as inquiries from businesses who might be interested in becoming future tenants at the site. Another article on the front page about the Courage Connection from Champaign by Rob LeCates. Career comes full circle for new director. While at the U of I, she volunteered at earlier incarnation of a nonprofit. It went by a different name when she worked there a dozen years ago, but Katie Harmon's return to what's now Courage Connection, this time as executive director, feels like a full circle moment for the survivor of domestic violence. Working in domestic violence has just always been a passion of mine, said the licensed social worker, who succeeded interim director Matthew Fletcher as permanent head of the Urbana-based nonprofit last month. These services are so important. They save lives. And I'm not just saying this, but I feel really humbled by this opportunity and very grateful to be able to do this. I think it's a privilege to be able to work with people in a really difficult time and establish that trust and rapport. I don't see it any other way. Courage Connection is a 24/7 service available for those experiencing domestic violence. The organization offers counseling services, a hotline, and emergency and short-term shelters. For families in need of emergency housing, it offers 10 apartment-style units, allowing children and parents their own room with a shared kitchen space. On average, families stay between 30 to 40 days, depending on their circumstances. The temporary shelter houses people between 6 months and a year, also depending on needs. An Arlington Heights native, Harmon moved to Champaign-Urbana to attend the University of Illinois in 2003. It was during her undergraduate studies that the sociology major took a class on social inequality, and learned more about how the systemic racism impacts people of color, which piqued her interest in social work. I feel like that class led me to really be committed and ask, what can I do as a professional and just as a member of the community to give, to help in some way, she said. At the time, she intended to delve into human services and work within her newfound community. During her 4 years at the U of I, Harmon interned at Planned Parenthood and the Center for Women in Transition, now known as Courage Connection. One of the most important pieces she brings to her new role as her own experience as a domestic violence survivor as a young adult. I know how I felt at the time, not knowing what resources might be available, not knowing who to talk to, and feeling really isolated and alone, she said. Harmon applied for the master's in social work degree, Path from the U of I and in her personal statement wrote about her experience and her initiative in getting involved with aiding domestic violence survivors. The first job she worked postgraduate school was at the Center for Women in Transition. The nonprofit received federal funding for homelessness prevention, whether it be from situations like evictions, medical emergencies, or unemployment. As an outreach case manager, she met with people at their homes in the community to check in and see how things were going and help provide support, she said. Sometimes people just need a little bit of support. We all do in life at times, she said. Harmon would assist clients in finding employment or childcare, filing for disability, or whatever else they needed. She worked with families who were survivors of domestic violence, who had to adapt back into an environment without danger, and could pursue careers or education. Eventually, she moved up to the role of interim executive director for about a year, then served as the program director in the early 2010s. After leaving the nonprofit, she spent nearly 9 years with the Champaign County Regional Planning Commission, first overseeing community service efforts for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and most recently serving as its homelessness-focused continuum of care coordinator. She's eager to bring those experiences into her new role. Having services to prevent people from losing their basic needs, like housing, is so crucial because how are people supposed to thrive in life if they don't have their basic needs met, she said. I absolutely love having that job. And there's an insert here with the heading, "That's the Spirit," and a picture of the lambs at 83 Vietnamese restaurant, the owners. And it says, head to the News Gazette Radio podcast section of our website and click on today's show to hear 83 Vietnamese owner Wayne Lam talk about the Champaign family business, which will receive one of the Experience CU's Brilliant Spirit Awards during the May 6th Toast to Tourism at Carmen's. Also to be honored, Chris and Ann Lukeman, CU Adventures in Time and Space and Parcadia, and Julie and Mark Hardy of the Hardy's Reindeer Ranch, Stephen Benz, Virginia Theater, Lauren and Jeffrey Brockish from Salt Fork Works, Martinelli's Market, Capre Restaurant, Picara Bistro, Espresso Royale Cafes, Prairie Fruits Farm and Creamery, and the Central Illinois Bakehouse. And congrats to those. Again, you can hear that on the News Gazette Radio podcast section of the News Gazette. Let's head over to Section A6 with an article from the Capital Coverage, Capital Connection from Chicago about Google's Waymo. The heading, "Testing Begins in Chicago as Bill Seeks to Legalize Autonomous Vehicles. Labor and driving unions are raising concerns over safety and job loss." In downtown Chicago, people have been spotting Google's Waymo, automated vehicles testing mapping the Windy City streets. For now, the autonomous vehicles must be driven by a human, as the industry seeks the endorsement of state lawmakers. For the last year, legislators in Springfield have been trying to work through a variety of issues raised by skeptics of the autonomous vehicles known as the AVs. Representative Cam Buckner, a Democrat from Chicago, said AV legislation has a long road ahead to address constituent concerns over safety, insurance, and job losses for rideshare and cab drivers. In January, he introduced the Autonomous Vehicle Pilot Project Act, which would open counties in Illinois with over 1 million residents, as well as the counties of Sangamon, Madison, St. Clair, and Monroe, to automated commercial vehicles. But the bill has since been held up in the Rules Committee, an early step in the process that means it's far from passage, especially in the current legislative session. Other bills supporting the industry also have yet to get the necessary support. While Waymo has started testing its vehicles with safety drivers in Chicago, the company has not yet announced plans to bring the robot taxis to counties other than Cook, according to Waymo spokesperson Chris Benelli. Automated vehicle legislation in Illinois. Waymo only fully operates in Arizona, California, Florida, Georgia, and Texas, warm weather states where concerns about handling icy conditions are not as big an issue. The company has faced significant questions over the safety of its vehicles and fully automated taxis. A subsidiary of Alphabet, Waymo is under multiple federal investigations for traffic violations, including illegally passing stopped school buses. Company vehicles have also made headlines for blocking emergency vehicles and hitting a child near an elementary school. In a statement, Bonelli said Waymo is committed to continuous improvement, adding, "While rare incidents will occur over the more than 4 million miles we drive every week, our entire fleet can learn from these events and continue to make our roads safer." According to company data, Waymo vehicles are involved in 92% fewer crashes with serious injuries compared to an average human driver in the same city. Among some legislators and observers, it seems a matter of time before legislative compromises eventually produce a bill that would pass to allow AVs to operate without the safety drivers. Representative Brad Stevens, a Republican who is also the mayor of suburban Rosemont, introduced his own AV bill last spring. He said he sees a bright future for AVs in Illinois, but he acknowledged that it might not pass this session. "It's going to be a challenging 2.5 months with a lot of other issues," Stevens said. "Still in the negotiation phase." P.S. Siraj, director of the Urban Transportation Center at the University of Illinois, outlined a host of challenges for AV safety in the state, but he also said he believes the vehicles eventually will become part of the life here. State officials, he said, should look for ways to implement new automations responsibly. The public benefit of AVs includes widening options for people who live in areas where there are few ride-share drivers or taxis. People with mental or physical disabilities around the state could also greatly benefit from AVs. "All of the mobility needs of a population are so diverse that these types of technological advancements could play a role," Srijaj said. But like others, he said he understands there are real concerns about safety, especially if AVs are to be allowed in smaller towns and counties. "If the infrastructure is not set up to support this kind of a technology, for example, if there is no lane marking visible, or at least to the naked eye, on a rural road, then what will happen to the technology?" he said. Labor lobbyist groups are at the forefront of opposition to Waymo, arguing that the automation will threaten driver and labor jobs. Ronnie Gonzalez, a representative of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, said it's vital that labor is part of the conversation before any legislation is passed. "In labor throughout the Industrial Revolution, we've been watching technology replace workers year after year, and it's only sped up in the recent decade," Gonzalez said. "The realization is it's going to happen. So having a seat at the table lobbying for legislation that implements the use of autonomous vehicles responsibly, that is mindful of workers and mindful of safety, is what labor is pushing for." His association is part of the Illinois Drivers Alliance, a coalition of thousands of rideshare drivers across the state fighting for unionization. He said he hopes to engage in conversation with Buckner about specifics in the bill. "We're still in the negotiation phase," Buckner said, "walking and talking through what the issues may be, what concerns may be, and trying to find a way to arrive at a version of this bill that works for everybody." Let's head over now to A7 under the opinions piece and check in with J. Mark Powell and his Holy Cow history. Today there's a very vintage black and white woodcut picture of Robert Ford assassinating an unarmed Jesse James on April 3rd of 1882 by shooting him from behind as James adjusted a picture hanging in his house in St. Joseph, Missouri, as Ford's brother Charlie looks on. And then there's a picture of Charlie Ford as he poses for a photo, reportedly with the gun he used to assassinate Jesse James, Robert Ford. There's a picture of both brothers, and the one with Robert, he's holding the gun that shot Jesse James. Let's start the article. "They killed Jesse James and paid for it. It was unusually warm in St. Joseph, Missouri that early spring morning. Mr. Howard, the man who rented the little wooden frame house at 1318 Lafayette Street, had just finished breakfast when he noticed that a print on the wall was hanging crooked. He stretched out his hands to straighten it, unaware that one simple act was about to set in motion a string of unintended consequences. Mr. Howard was, in fact, the outlaw Jesse James, an alias that he had used before. And it wasn't just the temperature that had him and his family laying low in the spring of 1882. The James gang had fallen on hard times, and Jesse was trying to, in modern terms, put the band back together for a criminal comeback. With many old members dead or in prison, it was time for new blood. Brothers Bob and Charlie Ford were handsome men in their early 20s who might have fit the bill. As the job description indicates, they were also crooks. In a classic example of no honor among thieves, while they were worming their way into Jesse James' confidence, they were also secretly negotiating with Missouri's governor for the $5,000 reward of James's head, and which is about $160,000 today. A deal was cut. Kill James and get the cash, plus a full pardon. Monday, April 3rd, 1882 arrived. With his guns resting on a nearby table, Jesse was straightening the picture when Bob Ford shot him from behind. Jesse James was no hero, but shooting an unarmed man from behind was the ultimate act of cowardice. Conspiring to collect $5,000 for it added to a Judas Iscariot dimension. That was the end of Jesse James's story. However, for Bob and Charlie Ford, karma was kicking in. The two backstabbing brothers wired the governor to collect their ill-gotten gains, then turned themselves in to the authorities. Imagine their surprise when they were indicted for murder, tried, found guilty, and sentenced to hang, all in just one day. 2 hours later, the governor spared them from the gallows with a full pardon. He shorted them on the reward, paying them only $500, a far cry from the $5,000 that they were promised. Politicians were no more trustworthy in the 19th century than today. It was all downhill from there for the brothers Ford. Killing a celebrity made them celebrities too, but in a bad way. Bob was viewed much like John Wilkes Booth, who also shot Abraham Lincoln from behind. Even people who loathed Jesse James felt he didn't deserve an ending like that. Bob and Charlie tried to cash in on their newfound fame. Bob posed for pictures in cheap arcades, a forerunner of pay-per-view. The brothers reenacted the shooting on stage, but the audience's dislike of them and their inability to act doomed the show. 2 years later, Charlie, riddled with tuberculosis and addicted to morphine because of the intense pain, died by suicide. Bob Ford stumbled from job to job. He opened a saloon in the New Mexico Territory, tried his hand as a police officer in Las Vegas, and finally wound up in Colorado, where he opened another saloon. When it burned down, he reopened it in a tent. Then it was on yet to another saloon in another town. He was working there on June 8, 1892, when a man walked in and said, "Hello, Bob." As he turned around, Edward O'Kelly fired both barrels of a double-barrel shotgun, killing Ford instantly. O'Kelly became known as the man who killed Jesse James, until he himself was killed in 1904 while trying to shoot a police officer in Oklahoma City. And so, the bloody trail of murders finally came to an end. It just goes to show you, you never know what chain of events your actions can set in motion, nor can you predict how or when they will stop. And the long, deadly path that produced such a high body count started 144 years ago this spring in that little frame house in St. Joseph, Missouri, with a betrayal by a supposed friend. Great story. How about another opinion piece, this time by Jim Dye? His heading is, "Sick of trying to look on the bright side? Do it anyway." Well, rats, William Shakespeare, the noted point guard and celebrated playwright, probably would have put it another way, noting that defeat is such sweet sorrow, but still sharper than a serpent's tooth. Us, U.S. hoopheads don't know no better than to lament the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, beweep our outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with our bootless cries, if only a few more shots had fallen. But with the dust settled in Michigan, a truly outstanding team crowned as champs, it's time to focus on the obvious. There's a lot to be said about the journey the Fighting Illini basketball fans were invited to take with an amazing, likable, and supremely talented group of players and coaches. In his post-game news conference after the Illini's tough Final Four loss to UConn on Saturday, head coach Brad Underwood acknowledged the pain of defeat, but took pride in the joy that his team brought fans this year. Joy? Darn right. A basketball season, even a great one, is filled with ups and downs, far more ups this year than downs, and that's part of the fun. It's a multi-month emotional roller coaster ride for fans that distracts from cold weather, animates conversations, focuses attention, and energizes lives. This year's team did even more than that. They, for the most part, put a smile on their fans' faces and the Illini fight song in their hearts. Joy? Was there anything as magical as the emergence of Keaton Wagler, our very own under-recruited superstar? How about Andrei Stojakovic's mind-boggling drives through multiple defenders to the hoop or Big Z's thunderous dunks? The multinational flavor was a fun addition, not talking about the two Hoosiers, Jake Davis and Ben Humerkus, but the real foreigners, Humerkus. As a matter of personal happiness, it's important to show gratitude. After all, it's what one has in life that matters, not what one doesn't have. That applies even to something as relatively unimportant as basketball. Let's face it, in the scope of life, it's just a game. No one dies at a center jump. What did Illini fans have this season? Energy, entertainment, and excitement. Even the cliffhanger losses had fans on the edge of their seats, wondering what's next. This year's team wasn't the first to do that. The explosive energy of the 1988-89 fly-in Illini was a sight to behold. The playmakers on the 2004 and 5 Illini were thrilling to watch as they flirted with an undefeated season and a national championship. In the end, each team fell short of the ultimate prize, leaving a temporary hole in our heart while filling it with great memories. As former U of I Chancellor Richard Herman said about the 2004-05 team, our stalwarts didn't let us down, they lifted us up. Grim experience shows that seasons like this don't come along very often. There are too many surprises. Injuries, upsets, transfers. To see a Final Four run is anything other than a long shot. Just take a look at this year's NCAA brackets for all the twists and turns that knocked other really good teams, number one seeds Duke and Florida, out of contention. Pursuing the sublime while fending off the ridiculous goes with the territory. Indeed, that's what makes it all the sweeter when good teams and good luck combine for a joyful run to the top of the heap. And we just have a couple minutes, so I will continue in our communities from the Champaign Police by Jana Wersima with an article entitled 18-year-old injured in Monday night shooting from Champaign. Police are seeking leads in a late-night shooting in North Champaign that left an 18-year-old injured. No arrests have been made as of Tuesday morning, police said. Officers were dispatched at 10:04 p.m. Monday to the 400 block of West Beardley Avenue for a report of a shooting with injuries. The victim was found at the scene with a gunshot wound to the leg and was cared for by police and fire personnel until he could be taken to a local hospital. The man was treated and released and continues to recover, police said. One resident in the area also sustained damage in the shooting. We are pursuing every lead, the police said. And then they give a number in case you have any information, 217-351-4545. And I will return with the second half of the News Gazette in just a few moments.